All right, Shabbat Shalom, and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning scripture study, coming to you live from the historic Temple Sinai Synagogue in St. Francisville, Louisiana, thanks to an arrangement with the Julius Freehand Foundation and with the West Feliciana Historical Society. We are pleased to be here with you. Thank you for joining us. Again, I wanted to say thank you to Ronnie Fulcher for last week. He covered for me. I had a busy week, as some of you know, and so I'm excited to get back into teaching. We are in the Bible's book of Exodus, and this is the subject of my class today. Couldn't come up with a better timing. It's something that I'm presently working on and researching, so I'm excited about the class today. So according to the annual cycle of Torah readings, we are now in the second parsha of the Torah's second book, the book called Shemot in Hebrew. Now, the word Shemot, the name Shemot, is taken, as are the names of other biblical books, based upon a significant word in the opening passage generally, and it means names. So last week, Ronnie taught a class on the opening Torah portion of the book of Exodus, and I'm not going back to pick up that because he covered that quite well. But what I did want to say is that this opening phrase, Ve'ele Shemot, and these are the names, is the basis for the name of the book in the Hebrew language. And Rabbi J.H. Hertz, who produced many works, but among them is one of my favorite commentaries. It's a commentary on the Pentateuch, the five books attributed to Moses, and the Haftarah. So he has a commentary, the text and commentary. And at the opening of the book of Shemot, he says, by way of introducing the book, but without providing a source for this, he says that the original name of the book of Shemot was called the Book of the Going Out of Egypt. The Book of the Going Out of Egypt. Now, I think, personally, for what it matters, that that is a better name for the book because, in a sense, the going out of Egypt is the central story, the main idea of the book. You can't pick up the book of Exodus and read that book without getting that the main idea is that the children of Israel are going out of Egypt. Now remember, the book of Genesis ends with the phrase, in Egypt. So we know that that's where they are, and the book of Exodus is concerned with the going out of Egypt, the Exodus. The English word Exodus comes to us, and it means the Exodus is the departure, the going out of Egypt. So in this particular instance, I think that this is a better name for the book. Now some might be a little bit taken back by that. But I have to tell you that these scrolls, as they are, didn't come with a title page. So these are later things that came in. For instance, Bereshi, which is the Hebrew name for Genesis, both Bereshi and Genesis both mean beginning. So I happen to agree. I like that title for that book. So these are just my personal preferences. It really doesn't necessarily belong in the class. But I want to stress the idea that the Exodus, the going out from Egypt, is the central theme. And I would argue that this story, the story of the going out from Egypt, is the single most important, the greatest story, if you will, ever told. Everything, for the most part, let's not be all inclusive, but for the most part, most everything in the book of beginnings leads us to this central event. and everything after it rests upon it. Now, understand this. So much of what follows, so much of what we believe, so much of what makes up our faith depends upon the veracity of this story, that if it were proven to not be true, understand what I said, if it were proven to not be true, then one's faith would prove to be in vain. You see where I'm coming from. Now, by the way, there are quite a few people who doubt the veracity of the story, or in some ways they doubt that it happened as it is recorded. There are various academics, there are various scholars who claim that this or that part is embellished or added to or expanded from the original. But I think it's so important that we deal with the subject matter associated with the Exodus, because so much depends upon it. Now, as we are presently in the book of Exodus, it is perfect timing for me to get into some teachings that are associated with this bedrock, foundational story. In fact, I ran it by the board of United Israel that our upcoming April conference, I proposed that the theme of the Exodus should be the theme of the conference. And you can expand that. Think of all the things you can do with it. You know, from the historical side of United Israel, United Israel has always maintained that the revelation at Sinai is that to which we look in terms of our faith and our practice. So when you think about it, David Horowitz used to always put a lot of his stationery and paper would say Mosaic Law for One World. You know, it all goes back, if you will, to Sinai, but several of us have been working on various projects. I'm currently working on a book that includes this, and the Tylers and I in particular are working very diligently on what is called the wilderness itineraries, the route. In other words, all of these things that you can connect to the Exodus. And so I think that this would be a very good theme for the conference. So look forward to that, and I will definitely keep you posted. The story of the Exodus. Now, I recently read an academic by the name of Richard Elliot Friedman, many of you know him, wrote a book called The Exodus, How It Happened and Why It Matters. And in that book, he starts off very soon into the book with a brief synopsis, if you will, of the story. And I just wanted to read that. It's a couple of paragraphs. Richard Friedman says, "It's a fabulous story. One of the best that we have. A kingdom overpowers a community of aliens in their country. The kingdom enslaves the aliens, and they kill their male children. But one baby survives. A princess takes him in as her own, and he grows up in royalty. As an adult, he kills a man who is assaulting one of his people. When his manslaughter becomes known, he flees to another land. There, he rescues a priest's daughter. He stays in that land, marries one of the daughters, has sons, lives tending flocks. And then he encounters God. Miracles occur. A mountain of God, a miraculous fire, an angel. The man's staff becomes a snake, then turns back as it was. The man's hand becomes leprous, then turns back as it was. And during all of this, God speaks, telling the man that God will free the enslaved people, and that the man must be the one to carry it out. He must go back, and God reveals his name to him. He returns, he faces the king. The king declines to let the people leave. The man initiates divinely ordered miracles, signs and wonders, 10 plagues on the kingdom, on land, water, and even blacking out the sun. Suffering for human, animal, plants, and finally death, but only to the firstborn humans and animals. The king yields, the people are freed to leave the kingdom. The king has a change of heart, and he and his army pursue them to the sea, but the sea splits and they pass through it, and it closes on the pursuing army. The people then trust in God and in the man, and they sing. More stories will follow. The people will go out to the mountain of God and will all encounter God. More miracles, more struggles, covenant with God, laws, a journey to their ancestors' homeland. Then the man will die and a new man will lead them there. But all of these stories depend on and flow out of what happened with the man Moses and the departure, the exodus from that kingdom from Egypt. So I want to begin a study, if you will, on the key elements of the story of the going out of Egypt. And all along the way, I want to show a couple of things. I want to draw out of the text a couple of points that I want to emphasize, such as how this incredible event shaped the people of Israel. I want to show how it prepared them for their ultimate role and destiny, if I can use that word. And I want to show how the events of the Exodus provide the reason for some of the laws, the rules, the statutes that become part of the Torah, and which ultimately changed the entirety of the world and human history for the better. Not just for the people of Israel, but for the entire world. I want to focus my time today primarily on one single idea, the beginning of the story. I want to focus on the idea of the phrases or terms that we've come to know: stranger, sojourner, resident alien, slave, and servant. Now, a lot of people prefer the use of the term servant over slave. But I'm talking about the Hebrew word eved, eved. When I talk about sojourner, when I talk about resident alien, I'm talking about the Hebrew word ger. Now I want to say at the outset that this today, nor in the weeks to follow, is not an exhaustive study of those terms. Nor am I in any way entering into the current fray, some of you know what I'm talking about, or the current debate in any of, let's say, the broader Torah faith movement currently creating divisiveness around these terms. There are people who are talking about the ger and the ger toshav and so forth and so on, and there's a lot of fighting. I'm not getting into that. I'm talking from the Bible about this story as I have explained. Now, before I get into it, I want to say that we're going to pass over, because we've gone through the book of Bereishit, the book of Genesis. I'm going to pass over the point in all of those references where the patriarchs referred to themselves as a stranger. You know, I'm a stranger in this land and so forth. You can do a study, and it is a very frequently used word. I want to begin my class today by looking at a dark vision. an ominous, dark vision given to Abraham. If you'll go with me to the book of Bereshit, to the book of Genesis, and I want to go to Genesis chapter 15, beginning in verse 13. Genesis 15, 13. And this is Jehovah speaking. And he said unto Abram, know of a surety that your seed shall be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also, that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance. But you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age, and in the fourth generation they shall come hither again. For the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. Now I want to stress to you that this particular vision is given to Avram, before he even has the promised seed Isaac. He's already being shown by God that there is trouble coming. But the end of the story is good. That there will be difficult times ahead. That the children of Israel, the descendants of Abraham, promised by a divine decree with so many wonderful blessings about being multitudinous, progeny and property is the way I put it. He's promised that he'll have seed as the stars of heaven, the sand of the sea, and so forth. What we find here is that God is telling Abram that part of their journey involves a stage of being sojourning in a land not theirs, and of being servants. He says, your seed will be a ger, a stranger, a sojourner, a resident alien in a land not theirs. Very clear, he's saying, they are going to be sojourning in a place that's not their land. He says that there, your seed, Avram, will be enslaved. They will be afflicted, oppressed, humiliated, all of which fit into the Hebrew word there, for 400 years. Another reference in your notes could be Exodus chapter 12, verse 40 and 41, where it says that the time that they were in the land of Egypt was 430 years, and there's just a lot of material on that. 400, 430, when do you start the count? You can look that up. It's not for this class. He goes on, he says, the nation that they will serve, the Hebrew word there, ayin beit dalet, we get the term servant or slave from. It means to work, to serve. He says that the nation that they will serve, the ones who enslave them, Jehovah says, I will judge them. And then afterwards, your descendants will come out. They won't come out empty-handed. And he says, in the fourth generation, they'll come back here. So the entirety of the plan, and so what I'm dealing with is the period of time from the sojourning in the land that's not theirs until they return to their land. This is the story that we're going to focus on. Primarily after the service is over to this nation, and when God begins to judge the people who they serve. Now the vision that God gives Avram sets the stage for the main components or the main parts of the Exodus story, the greatest story ever told. The Joseph saga explains in great detail the workings both on the scene and behind the scenes of how it is that Abram's seed ends up in a land not theirs. We just worked through the Joseph saga. It gives us all the background, how it took place, and how God's guiding hand not only moved things to put Joseph there to preserve life and so forth and so on. Everything was being worked to fulfill the vision that Jehovah gave to Avram. Ultimately, they do end up as slaves. Now, this element of the story, the idea that the heroes, the people of God, the people that are the main focus of the Tanakh, the point that they have an origin as slaves and servants and strangers in a land not theirs, it has a sort of a ring of authenticity to it. Right? I mean, if you were going to write a history of your people, would you begin it like that? Yeah, we were servants, we were slaves, and, you know, it's just, most people would want to say, well, we go back, we're royal back to the very beginning of time. But the story, even the skeptics and the minimalists admit that this part of the story seems to ring true, even if they doubt other details in the story. We were slaves at first. And Friedman covers this to great detail in his work. Not only does the narrative that we're dealing with record the humble beginnings of the people of Israel, but it makes a point to recall this part of the story and to perpetuate and to pass down throughout the generations this single point. Now, I might add, because this is part of the research that I'm doing for a book that I'm working on, I want to say this. You might be surprised and think that it's everywhere. There's one book of the Bible that stresses to the people of Israel to recall this particular point. You want to guess which one? The subject matter of my own book, the book of Deuteronomy. Now, I'm speaking of a particular, very clear statement, unambiguous, that's used 6 times, all of which appear in Deuteronomy and only in Deuteronomy. Nowhere else. This phrase, "You were slaves in Egypt. You were slaves in Egypt." I'm going to go through these texts. Again, there are 6 of these. 6 times in the Torah, only in the book of Deuteronomy, it says, "You were slaves in Egypt," and 5 of those 6 come associated with the command, "Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt." 5 times. Okay. So go with me to Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 15. I'm just going to roll through these. I'm not going to give the context. I just want to make the point. "You were slaves in Egypt. And you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and Jehovah your God brought you out thence by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. Therefore, Jehovah your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day." You were a slave, you were a servant, and therefore God commands you to keep the Sabbath. Now, we'll get into, at some point, why Is there an association between you were slaves in Egypt and therefore Jehovah brought you out and he commands you to keep the Sabbath? What do the two have to do with one the other? Go to Deuteronomy chapter 15 and verse 15. And you shall remember that you were a bondman, you were a servant, you were a slave, same Hebrew word, in the land of Egypt, and Jehovah your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this thing today. Notice there is an association with you were a slave, and therefore do this. You were a slave, therefore do this. In each case, remember that you were a slave and do this. Somehow, some way, for some reason, the association with you were a slave, God redeemed you, therefore keep and guard and do. We'll talk. Go to chapter 16 of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 16 and verse 12. Deuteronomy 16, 12. And you shall remember that you were a bondman in Egypt. You were a slave, a servant. And you shall observe and do these statutes. See there, once again. Once again. Look at chapter 24, Deuteronomy 24, and verse 18. You shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt. I'm just going to use the word slave. It's very harsh. It's raw, but it is the main meaning. And this was an oppressive regime. This was a humiliation. It was the worst of the worst. You were a servant, a slave in Egypt, and Jehovah your God redeemed you thence. Therefore, I command you to do this thing. And then look down at verse 22. And you shall remember that you were a servant, slave in the land of Egypt, and therefore I command you to do this thing. Now, there is a more commonly used phrase, and I want to go through quite a few texts. I'm going to go through them, but I'm going to hit them and move on because I'll tie it all together at the end. There is another phrase that's used more commonly to refer to the slavery of God's people in Egypt. And that is used 13 times, and it's mibet avadim. It's in reference to the fact that God, Jehovah, redeemed you from a house of bondage. From a house of bondage, or a house of slavery, a slave house. He redeemed you. Egypt is referred to as a Beit Avadim. Go with me to Exodus chapter 13. Exodus 13 and let's see. Verse 3, Exodus 13, 3. And Moses said to the people, remember this day in which you came out from Egypt, out of the house of servant or bondage, Beit Avadim, for by strength of hand Jehovah brought you out from this place, and therefore you shall not eat leavened bread. You're going to see over and over, you were a slave, you were in a house of slaves, and therefore you're going to do this. You're going to eat this because you were a slave. You're going to keep this day holy because you were a slave. You're going to observe to guard and do these things because you were a slave. Don't forget it. Strange. Go down in chapter 3 to verse 14. And it will be when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is this that you shall say unto him? By strength of hand, Jehovah brought us out from Egypt and from the house of bondage. And it will come to pass, so forth and so on. In other words, whenever your son's, why are we doing this? Because We were slaves. We were servants in a house of bondage. Go to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 12. Beware. Deuteronomy 6:12. Beware lest you forget Jehovah, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall fear Jehovah your God and serve him and so forth and swear by his name. Look down at chapter 7 and verse 8. Deuteronomy 7:8. Because Jehovah loved you, because he would keep the oath which he swore unto your fathers, hath Jehovah brought you out with a mighty hand, redeemed you out of the house of bondage from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. 8:14. I'm not going to read all of them, but I'll make sure that you have them in your notes. Deuteronomy 8:14. Then your heart be lifted up, and you forget Jehovah your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Let me see if I want to pick these up. Bear with me one second. Okay. All right, let me just give you the rest of these and let you look them up on your own. John Baruch Perry will put these in the notes. The other references to the house of bondage, or redeeming one from the house of bondage, are chapter Deuteronomy 13:6, verse 5 in the English, 13:5, Deuteronomy 13:10, Joshua 24:17, Judges chapter 6, verse 8, Jeremiah 34, verse 13, and Micah chapter 6, verse 4. Let's look at that one together. Micah chapter 6 and verse 14. Now, the interesting thing is that this idea of the redemption from Egypt and the command to remember extends throughout the biblical literature. So it's not just something that does occur in only one book or in only one story. It is constantly referred to and looked back to. Micah chapter 6, verse 4, I think I said 14, I meant verse 4. For I brought you up out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you out of the house of bondage, and I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. So, the other important point, and this is for another class, is to stress that Jehovah makes a name for himself with this salvific act, with this redemptive act of bringing his people out of the land of Egypt. He will be known throughout the biblical period and even to this day as the God who saved Israel out of Egypt. It's so important that it is etched on stone according to our record. John reads it every Shabbat to you. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 2. Look at that. Exodus 20 and verse 2. It's also in Deuteronomy 5:6, but Exodus chapter 20, verse 2, when Jehovah introduces himself before, as he's delivering the 10 words, he says, I am Jehovah your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. This key point is not only recorded time and again in Hebrew scriptures, the people of Israel are commanded to remember it, they are commanded to pass it down, and in some way, there is something about their time in servitude to Pharaoh and to Egypt that is associated with the keeping of the laws which they will receive. Now, I also want to point out that while the Exodus is indeed a story of redemption, it's a story of freedom and deliverance, you should know that it's not merely a relief from servitude, but rather it's a story about an exchanging of masters. In other words, one might say, the Israelis could say, free at last, thank God Almighty, I'm free at last, to quote the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. But perhaps an even more accurate saying would be, free at last, thank God Almighty, I'm free at last to be a servant to Jehovah, my true master, my true Lord. I shall not bow down, I shall not serve any other gods. Because for the people specially chosen by Jehovah, they remain servants forever, but his servants. The message from Jehovah to Pharaoh and to Egypt is clear throughout the story. Doesn't change. Moses is told, you go to Pharaoh and tell him this, shalak et ami, translated, let my people go. And we've become familiar with it in that phrase, let my people go. My translation is slightly different. I would say, send forth my people. You see, there is a form of a Hebrew word or a grammatical term called a jussive, which is more of a let my... But this tends to come across more direct. It's not like, hey, let my people go. It's send forth my people. Now, there's a couple of points I want to focus on. Send forth is not let. It's the directive to send forth. And then the other part of that is my people. So it's a strong message in a very short phrase. He's telling the king of the world at the time, they don't belong to you. Send them out. Now, this phrase, shalak et ami, occurs over and over in the story. This is our story. Now, from the very beginning, when the Exodus story begins, Ronnie covered this last week in his class. Look at Exodus 3:12. Exodus 3:12. Moses is being told by God, this is when he first meets God, and he said, certainly I will be with you. And this shall be the token or sign unto you that I've sent you. When you have brought forth the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Now, it's not just any old mountain. People debate, where is Horeb? Where is Sinai? This event takes place at Horeb. And so he tells him, when you leave, I'm going to be with you. And here's going to be a sign for you, Moses. You're going to serve God on this mountain. Now, what does that mean, serve God on this mountain? It's a very specific place. And I want to focus on this idea that the message throughout is, let my people go, send forth my people so they may serve me. Let me say it a little bit stronger.
Send forth my people that they may serve me.
Not you. They're my people. They're going to serve me. Send them forth. Look at chapter 4. Exodus chapter 4, verse 22 and 23. And you shall say unto Pharaoh, thus saith Jehovah, Israel is my son, my firstborn, and I have said to you, let my son go, that he may serve me. And you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will slay your son, your firstborn. Look at chapter 7, Exodus chapter 7. Exodus 7, this is part of our Torah reading, by the way, verse 16. You shall say unto him, Jehovah, the God of the Hebrews, has sent me unto you, saying, send forth my people that they may serve me in the wilderness, and behold, hitherto you've not hearkened. I'm using the ASV. I really do like, I study the ASV a lot. I like that. Hitherto. Hitherto thou hast not hearkened. Point's clear. Send forth my people that they might serve me in the wilderness, and thus far you've not complied. So he steps it up. Now go to chapter 8, verse 1. If you're in a Hebrew Bible, I think it's chapter 7, verse 26. A little bit different there. Let me look. Yep, 7:26 in Hebrew. 8:1, Exodus 8:1. Jehovah spoke unto Moses, go in unto Pharaoh and say unto him, thus saith Jehovah, send forth my people that they may serve me. Chapter 9, verse 1. Chapter 9, verse 1. Jehovah said unto Moses, go in unto Pharaoh and tell him, thus saith Jehovah, the God of the Hebrews, send forth my people that they may serve me. You hear any change in the... It's not like he changes what he's telling him. Verse 13. Jehovah said unto Moses, rise up early in the morning, stand before Pharaoh and say unto him, thus saith Jehovah, the God of the Hebrews, send forth my people that they may serve me. Any ambiguity? Do you think that at some point Pharaoh would say, I know, let your people go so that they can serve Jehovah? It's every, when he comes, he says, he doesn't say a lot of other stuff, right? It's very clear. Thus saith Jehovah, the God of the Hebrews, send forth my people that they may serve me. Message is clear. You're no longer the one they will serve. Your reign over my people is ended. And then chapter 10, Exodus 10, verse 3. Moses and Aaron went into Pharaoh and said unto him, thus saith Jehovah, the God of the Hebrews, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Send forth my people that they may serve me. Now, one of the key takeaways from the experiences of slavery for God's people. One of the things that comes out strongly in the text, remember, one of the things that I want to do is show you from the Hebrew Bible not only how these events and experiences shape the people of Israel, but I want to show you how these things became embodied within the instructions that God gave them, shaped even their behavior for all generations. Listen, this was not good, but it was training. This was not a good experience, but it was good experience.
Does that make sense?
Richard Elliot Friedman covers this, but let me make this very, very clear. The one thing that comes through from this experience of slavery, that is, it becomes embodied in divine law, is that God's people, having now belong only to Him and serving only Him, know what it is like. They were to remember what it was like to be oppressed and to be abused and humiliated. And they are not to do that to others. They were to learn a very important lesson. It's embodied in divine law, that they were to learn to not treat others the bad way that they had been treated. Friedman records more than 30 Torah texts, 30, that defined what we call good and equal treatment demanded by holy law and to be extended beyond the people of Israel to strangers, sojourners, ger. Again, people love to fight over this stuff. Well, it doesn't mean this, it means that. Look, I'm saying that 30 texts can be directly tied to this idea of how you treat these others. Now, five of these texts are enough to, it's enough to suffice, in other words, to make my point. I want you to listen closely to these five key takeaways. I want you to go with me to Exodus chapter 22, 20. Exodus 22, 20. And a sojourner, a ger, you shall not wrong, neither shall you oppress him, because you were sojourners in Egypt. Now think about that. You shall not wrong a stranger. Don't oppress him. That's powerful. Now I want you to look at, by the way, in the Hebrew, that's verse 21. Look at Exodus 23. Exodus 23 and verse 9. A sojourner you shall not oppress, because you know the heart of a sojourner, seeing that you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. You get the power of that? You're not to oppress. You're not to do wrong to. You're not going to do these things to a sojourner because you know the heart of a sojourner. You know what the things that I love about the Torah more than anything? Where it really speaks to the heart. You know, there are things, there are legislative pieces in the Torah that says, don't do this to a person because they will cry to me and I will hear it. Think about that. If you take someone's something special from them in a pledge and you feel like I have every right to do this, Jehovah says in His law, you don't want to do this because they're going to cry to me and I'm going to hear it. In other words, you will have yours coming. Think, we have to think beyond just ourselves, and we have to know the heart of those who are afflicted and oppressed. The reason Israel suffered was so that it might learn through the things they suffered as a servant
And they are then compelled to be a servant with a heart. Look at Leviticus 19. Leviticus 19. Leviticus 19 and verse 33. 19:33. And if a stranger sojourn with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. The stranger that sojourns with you shall be unto you as the homeborn among you, and you shall love him as yourself, because, yep, you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. I am Jehovah your God. So you have someone who is in your land that it's not theirs. How do you treat them according to the Torah? Just like the homeborn. I mean, this is what it says. All right, look at Deuteronomy 10. Deuteronomy chapter 10. In verse 19. Well, let me back up. Let's look at verse 17. Jehovah your God, he is God of God, Lord of lords, the great God, the mighty, the terrible, who regards not persons nor taketh reward. He doth execute justice for the fatherless and widow, and loves the sojourner. He loves the sojourner. In giving him food and raiment. Love ye, you love the stranger. Because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall therefore fear Jehovah your God. Him you shall serve. How do you serve God? Look, a servant, called by God to be a servant, the biblical servant, is to serve God. But because this service is associated with the laws that are given, you can serve God in your servitude to others. And it's made clear over and over. It's one thing to say, I serve God, and treat your neighbor badly, or your stranger, or a sojourner. You're not serving God. I mean, that's just plain. You may think you are. You may say you are. You may fool some of the people some of the time, but you'll fool Jehovah none of the time. Deuteronomy 23 and verse 8. You shall not abhor an Edomite. He's your brother. You shall not abhor an Egyptian, because you were a sojourner in his land. You know, the Torah spends a lot of energy and a lot of words to tell us that Egypt is the bad guys. Right? You read through the story. I mean, when they drowned on the seashore, the crowd erupts in applause. You know, they've been saved. They've been redeemed. But even their arch enemy, Egypt, God says, don't abhor them because you were a stranger in their land. You sojourned there. Now the Torah sometimes takes us to an uncomfortable place. Sometimes you just want to hate somebody. I mean, you know, some people are hard to love. Right, Lyndon? Sometimes It's difficult, but it's in those difficulties that God can really mold us into who it is that we should be. And I'm not saying I'm there yet. These texts drive us to be better, to be more, more and more and more for those who need. The story of the Exodus and the Torah, which tells that story, which we are to remember, and we are to even remember, according to the Torah, that you were slaves. But one of the main reasons you're to remember that is so that you know that heart, you know that humility, you know that oppression, and you don't do it to others. You want to know why the Jewish people, I'm not getting into politics, believe me. You know what? You want to know why the Jewish people are such social activists? How they stand up for the oppressed? You want to know why? It's this. That's the reason. They stand up for people that to the rest of us might be dregs of society. We might look at certain groups or classes or races or whatever. Hopefully we don't, but let's face it. We might look at some people and not stand up on their behalf. Jewish people typically won't do that. A lot of my friends say, why are the Jewish people so liberal, so this, so that, so this? You know, and it is, a lot of people in Torah faith, they're very conservative in their views. I'm telling you why. You may not agree. You know that the Egyptians, the bad guys in our story, ultimately, God calls them His people. Isaiah chapter 19. Isaiah 19 calls Egypt my people. Same thing he refers to Israel. He calls Assyria and Egypt thirds with Israel my people. It's like a reunion of all the good and the bad. It's like, hey, Israel, I want you to meet somebody. It's Pharaoh. It's the king of Assyria. And come on in, guys. Come on. You are all my people. I mean, sometimes when we read the biblical stories, there's an interesting twist. Don't abhor, it says in Deuteronomy 23:8. Don't abhor an Egyptian. You were a sojourner in his land. And the Israelites could say, yeah, but remember how they did us, you know? And he says, yes, I remember. And you should remember too. The story of the Exodus relates that a specially chosen people will be strangers in a land not theirs. That they will be enslaved and oppressed. But that at the right time, Jehovah says that he will judge the oppressors and deliver his people to service to him in a land designated for them by him. And they will serve him by following his ways in their land that he gave to them. This is the heritage of Jehovah's people. In Hebrew, there is a word, morashah. Now, some of the things that I find in my studies, you know, I love to find words and phrases which are very rare, precious. And sometimes I come across things in my study, you do as well, that I say, that's one of the greatest things I've ever seen. Here's one of those. I'm going to share with you the heritage of God's people. It's only used, Morishah is only used two times in Scripture. Exodus chapter 6, verse 8. Exodus 6, 8. I will bring you in unto the land which I swore to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, and I will give it to you for a heritage. I am Jehovah. He says he's giving a land that he swore to the forefathers. He's giving that land as a morishah. The root word there is a possession, a heritage. So that's one thing that God says, this is the heritage of my people. It's the land that I promised. Now look at Deuteronomy 33, verse 4. Deuteronomy 33, verse 4. Moses commanded us a Torah, an inheritance for the assembly of Jacob. Only two things in the Torah are described as the heritage of God's people: the land and the Torah. Now, one passage ties these two together, and it summarizes my class. Go to Deuteronomy 6, and I want to read verse 20 and following. When your son asks you in time to come, saying, what mean the testimonies, the statutes, and the ordinances which Jehovah our God has commanded you? And you shall say unto your son, we were Pharaoh's servants in Egypt, and Jehovah brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And Jehovah showed signs and wonders great and sore upon Egypt, upon Pharaoh, and upon all his house before our eyes. And he brought us out from there, and that he might bring us in to give us the land which he swore unto our fathers. And Jehovah commanded us to do these statutes, to fear Jehovah our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as it is this day. And it will be righteousness unto us if we observe to do all this commandment before Jehovah our God as he has commanded us. Let me make sense of that. He says that the purpose of the teaching of the Torah, the purpose of the Torah, when you're asked, what is all this about? All of this, the Torah, the living of the Torah, what is this all about? You're to say, we were servants in Egypt. Jehovah judged our oppressors. He brought us back to the land that he swore to our fathers, and he's done that. And he's commanded us to do all these things. There's a direct line that runs through the predictions of the vision explained to Avram down to our day. It has proven true. Israel was sojourning in a land not theirs. A new king arose over Egypt. He began to oppress, and the people began to oppress. And God heard their groaning, and at the right time, as he had declared, he judged the nation that oppressed his people. He brought them out with a mighty hand and gave them laws, instructions, statutes, and judgments. And among those was to remember the heart of that early, humble, oppressed, afflicted stage and never do it again. Likewise, we should take these lessons to heart. And we should examine the way we think about things. And we should apply these things as we look around us and say, what can I do, what should I do, knowing the bad that I've experienced? Think about that. Shabbat Shalom.